Periodically, I'm asked to supply to our communications department a description of this service and its congregation. And as Michael knows well, because he works with me on communications issues, I often struggle with this. But this morning, I think I have the answer. This is church for the exceptionally well-behaved. I mean, if you grew up going to church, chances are you mastered the rules of church. The first of these is, of course, no talking, followed closely by no fidgeting and no running, followed by no shorts, no water pistols, no comic books. Right? You were not to bring food or drinks of any kind into the sanctuary, probably because on the first Sunday of the month, church would provide the food and drinks. Everybody got a little piece of bread and a little shot of juice. We learned that cleanliness is next to godliness, and the pews are not a jungle gym. It was clear that the hymnals were not meant to be used as clipboards or the little offering envelopes as coloring books. Although my parents often relaxed the latter rule, especially when my sisters and I became fidgety and were in danger of breaking rule number two. Now, breaking the rules usually resulted in a stern look from my parents or a gentle but firm squeeze on some appendage, though apparently the punishment for misbehavior in church could be much worse. There is a priest who opines that there must be a special place in purgatory for those who leave chewing gum underneath the pew. I was reading one church's website, who kindly provided a lengthy and detailed list of do's and don'ts, thou shalt not do this and thou shalt not do that, which I thought was ironic in that the final rule in this list was, enjoy the worship service. The church has always been concerned about what constitutes appropriate behavior in church, even before it was the church, when it was still the synagogue, when it was still the worshiping people of Israel gathered around Torah. Having grown up in the synagogue, Jesus knew the rules and regulations. He knew the ins and outs of synagogue. He was devoted to the very scriptures on which those rules and regulations were based, and he was teaching those same scriptures in the synagogue that day, that Sabbath day, when suddenly there appeared in the midst of them a woman with a spirit that had crippled her for 18 years. The woman was bent over, almost literally doubled over, and she was quite unable to stand up straight. Now, one of the rules of polite society, to say nothing of church, is that you shouldn't stare at those with visible physical difficulties or deformities or differences. And the people of that synagogue had probably stared so long that they simply no longer saw the curvature of her spine that confined her world to the area just around her feet. Isn't it easy to look past the widows and widowers among us who are bent over by grief and loneliness? Isn't it easy to look past the middle-aged adult stooped by prolonged underemployment or the cares of tending to aging parents and growing children? Isn't it easy to look past the teenagers hunched over by a load of expectation and anxiety? For all of our modern scientific attempts to assay a medical diagnosis, Luke, whom tradition says was himself a physician, says that the woman's physical condition is the result of an unseen spiritual reality. She wasn't simply sick. It wasn't just that she carried around within her body microbes or bacteria or a virus. No, the woman lived and labored under a demonic foreign power. She was possessed. She was possessed by a spirit of weakness, a spirit of infirmity. This spirit had pushed her over, bent her out of shape, deformed her. For 18 long years, this evil spirit denied her the power to stand up straight and hold her head high, to see the world as it really is. Although the rules have taught us politely to look away, the presence of the bent over woman in our own midst this morning forces us to ask, what spirits cripple us? Linda Fabian Peep says that when you are crippled by a spirit, there is something that has gotten hold of you or taken control of your life, something that has got power over you. And so by what spirit are you crippled? Is it a spirit of addiction, whether to alcohol or prescription medication or to gambling or online pornography? Are you bound by a spirit of acquisition, unhappy until you get more and more and more and more? Are you bound by a spirit of fear, whether of international terrorism or of people in our presence who are different from you? Are you bound by a spirit of failure, that you simply aren't good enough or smart enough or attractive enough to succeed? What binds you this morning? What spirit has you under its power? What spirit imprisons you and holds you in its power until you are bent over to the point of breaking? It's at that point, my friends, that Jesus sees us, just as he saw the woman in the synagogue that day. It's at that point that Jesus speaks to us as he spoke to her, saying, "You are set free." Simply by speaking, Jesus untied the ropes that fettered her, broke apart the chains that had held her, and he let her go. And the good news is that Jesus can do the same for you and me. Jesus can heal us. Jesus can liberate us. Jesus can deliver us. Jesus can redeem us, and we need him to, because like the bent over woman, we are quite unable to stand up straight. We are without the power to be in the world as God has created us and called us to be in the world. But Jesus, friends, Jesus has the power to heal us and to set us free. Now, you might expect that this sort of miraculous healing might win the rabid applause of the gathered religious community. You might think that this manifestation of God's healing power and presence in a hurting world would have everyone on their feet clapping wildly, and for the most part, that is true. Everyone there rejoiced at the wonderful things that Jesus was doing. Everyone, that is, but one. The synagogue leader, the religious leader of this particular faith community, became indignant. He grew angry because Jesus had healed on the Sabbath. His objection is not that the healing has happened, but that the healing has happened on the Sabbath, on the holy day, when it should not happen. It was, to use a term of parliamentary procedure, out of order. It wasn't appropriate church behavior. It was, in fact, a clear violation of the rules, specifically rule number 4, which said, remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. On it, you shall do no work. And not working included doing the work of healing. If people wanted to be healed, the synagogue leader said, the synagogue is open Sunday through Friday, 8 to 5. Please call ahead and make an appointment. We will be glad to cure you then. but don't come on the Sabbath day. Those are simply the rules, and rules are rules, and not only that, but there was in fact good reason for the rules. The good reason behind the no work rule is this: if God himself rested from the work of creation on the seventh day, God's people need to rest from their work as well. God's creatures should copy their Creator. But then Jesus, whom I think last week Josh said was angry Jesus, rude Jesus, inappropriate Jesus, has the audacity to point out the hypocrisy of this particular theological position. Religious leaders hate when Jesus does that, points out their own hypocrisy. Does not each of you, Jesus says to those in the crowd, does not each of you work on the Sabbath day by going out to your barn and untying your ox or your donkey from its tether to the feed trough and then lead it away to give it water? And if you do work on the Sabbath, then ought not this woman, who could be your mother, or your wife, or your sister, or your daughter, indeed, ought not this daughter of Abraham, this fellow member of the faith community, this heiress to the promises of God, ought she not to be set free, seeing that she has not been so much as tied to a feed trough, but bound by Satan for 18 long years? I recognize that Satan is not a popular figure among Methodists or indeed among mainline Christians. We like to think that we long ago outgrew Satan as a personification of evil. To our materialist, empiricist way of thinking, Satan is a mythological figure right up there with Zeus and Thor and Ra and just as real. But friends, Jesus takes Satan seriously, and so perhaps should we. We've already seen, after all, how each of us can fall victim to the power of demonic spirits. Along those lines, then, may I encourage you to entertain this observation from John W.B. Hill, who says, "Satan is the organizing principle of conventional culture. And Jesus undertook to expose the reign of Satan, which is the culture of death." I think that bears repeating. Satan is the organizing principle of conventional culture, and Jesus undertook to expose the reign of Satan, which is the culture of death. What I think this means is not simply that the devil is often in the details, he usually is, but the devil is often in the rules, or at least in our application of them. And we must be honest with ourselves, church rules can often be the deadliest. Dress appropriately, rule number one. And I'm fully aware that we are promoting next week as Seersucker Sunday. Dress appropriately can be a way the church has of saying, you don't belong here. My colleague Phil Deakey tells of a young woman, a student, coming down from SMU dressed in a pencil skirt. Somewhere around the parking lot, someone from our congregation stopped her and said, "Sweetie, you don't need to wear that here." At which point the young woman turned around and went back to her door. The rules: no talking, no fidgeting, no crying babies, no chattering children, sends the message that church should be silent as the grave. But it also suggests that that's where the church believes we will find God. No food or drinks of any kind in church says that your hunger and thirst are not welcome here. But friends, is it not precisely those needs that God offers to meet when he comes to us in bread and wine? Brothers and sisters, I am not this morning advocating anarchy in church, nor am I suggesting that we do away with the rules. I'm old-fashioned enough to think that wearing nice clothes to church can be a way by which we honor God. I'm also vain enough to think that most people want to hear the sermon uninterrupted. Let's give the rules their credit. Rules usually help us to order our lives and keep the peace among us. They establish the boundaries within which human life can flourish. But we also need to realize that the rules that bound the synagogue leader can also bind us. The rules can be invoked to protect institutions rather than individuals. The rules can be made to serve special interests rather than the public interest. The rules can be used to exclude on the basis of color or gender or sexual orientation or educational status or socioeconomic background. The rules can do harm and not good, even or especially to those who do not make the rules. And in that way, the rules can enforce the culture of death. Now, I confess, as a preacher, it might be tempting to conclude this morning by saying that Jesus broke all the rules, and so present Jesus to you as edgy, rebellious, countercultural, a rebel with a divine cause. Then I'd be hip. People would flood in the doors. I'd be popular. Or at least I hope I would be. But Jesus doesn't break the rules so much as he bends them. For in God's kingdom, the rules must always bow. They must always bow to mercy, to life, to freedom, to justice, to healing, to wholeness, to grace. Jesus, friends, exhibited some frankly inappropriate church behavior when he healed the daughter of Abraham on that Sabbath day. He bent the rules and set her free. When he bent the rules and broke the no work on the Sabbath rule, Jesus also broke the culture of death. When he unbound the bent over woman from Satan's grasp, Jesus also bound up all those spirits that imprison and overpower us. And so, my brothers and sisters, stand up straight. Hold your head high, live into the fullness of that divine image in which you have been created and called by God. For Jesus has set you free.